Welcome to Family Dynamics and Impact of Wealth. In a world where talking about the impact of money is difficult, we share stories and tips for reducing the negative impact that significant wealth can have on our emotions, relationships, and behaviors. Now here's your host, Ginny Galisonow.
Good day, everyone. Today we have with us Molly Stranahan, who is a fourth-generation heir of the Champion Spark Plug family. Molly believes her good fortune comes with the responsibility to use the gifts and resources she has been blessed with in this lifetime to leave the world a better place, with less suffering and more love and happiness. Molly spent the first decade of her adult life as a trust officer and business consultant, and the second decade getting a doctorate in psychology from Rutgers University. In 2002, she created The Path to Happiness, through which she shares with others what psychology knows about the choices we can make to live happier, healthier, and more fulfilled lives. She currently works with individuals and presents workshops. For the last 18 years, she has been a leader and presenter at the Summer Institute, a volunteer-run annual four-day personal growth retreat for inheritors of financial wealth and their partners. Over 800 people have attended a class she created and led at Miraval in Tucson, Arizona, on the path to peace about money. So, Molly, I imagine that could have been a very interesting legacy to grow up with. How did you find out that you were rich? And if so, did you actually feel that you were different?
You know, I knew my grandparents and great-grandfather were rich. They lived in big houses and had servants. We didn't. My father was a professor, and we lived in academic communities. When I really found out, I was in the seventh grade. We'd recently moved to this town when I started sixth grade. And one day at school, a girl in my class said, "Molly, your family's rich." And I said, "No, we're not," because I didn't think we were. And that day I went home and asked my father, "Dad, Mary Rooker said that we're rich. Why would you say that?" And he said, "Well, actually, she might, you know, there is a way we are rich." And he said, "You know, if you think of the distribution of wealth as a bell curve," since he was a professor, "and so the average is about C," he said, "we're a B plus. So we have more than the average person," which actually was a very good way to give me a perspective, because the word rich is so loaded. Mm-hmm. And it's usually something we don't, you know, obviously I didn't want to be it. I denied it to Mary.
Right.
Like it was a bad thing to be. So it was helpful to say, well, we're not the very top, but we are better off than most people. And it gave me a sense of how we might be perceived differently than I thought of myself.
So what did you do with that information? I mean, did it change the way you interacted with friends at that very young age? Did it change the way you thought of yourself at that young age?
I don't think it really did change the way I thought of myself. I didn't particularly talk about it to anybody else. You know, it was kind of like, it felt like a sort of a shameful secret. Even though my father had been open in answering the question, there definitely was a message of that it's something that you don't talk about, that it's something that can make other people feel bad. And so that it felt like a secret. And of course, whenever you have a secret, there's usually some sense of shame around it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So how did you actually learn about your own inheritance?
You know, that was about a year later when I was in the eighth grade. And in my math class, we were supposed to pick four stocks to follow. So, you know, it was a way of learning practical math. And so I was telling my father about our assignment. And he said, "Well, why don't you pick stocks you actually own?" And I mean, this is the first I'd even heard about stocks. And he went to his file cabinet and he pulled out a statement for a trust account that had been set up for me when I was very young. and showed me how to read the trust statement and showed me the listing of the stocks that were held, including Champion Spark Plug. And he told me, you know, that I actually owned some of this company, as well as my grandfather working for it and my great grandfather having started it with his brother, which actually was a fabulous way to learn about this. You know, it was in a context of something I was doing at school. It was practical. He gave me real information. And then after that, if I wanted to see the statements, he, you know, always made them available. So I really like how that worked.
And how old were you at that time?
I was in the eighth grade, so I must have been about 13.
In eighth grade. So when I imagine when you went back to school, did you talk about the stocks and did you actually talk about them in terms of these are stocks I actually own?
No, I didn't. I just, you know, we all just, I mean, mostly people pick stocks that were in common, you know, IBM and Xerox. And I think I had a couple of those. I think I was the only person who had Champion Spark Plug, but I didn't say why I had chosen that company.
Okay. So would you say that this was really the very first serious conversation you had had about your inheritance? Because I seem to remember another one where you shared with me something about when you were in college and you heard about an inheritance in a different way.
Yes. And that was probably really the next time there was a conversation about it overtly. I mean, I noticed that when we visited my grandparents, my father and his siblings and his father would go off and have meetings. I didn't even know that it was about money. But when I was in college, my parents separated right as I was going off to college. And my mother's home was where I was based. And so I would have to have my tuition bills forwarded from that address to my dad's. And then he would have the family office, or it's actually the bank where the trusts were, pay the tuition. And it was late. So I'd get to school and I couldn't eat meals in the dining hall because my meal ticket hadn't been paid. So I asked for some quicker assistance around that happening. And my father said, well, you have a trust account. Why don't you use that to pay your tuition? So that led me to go to the bank where this trust account was held and to learn about how I could make that happen, how I could get distributions. And they went over what was in the trust and actually showed me there was more than one trust at that point. I had known about the one Dad had talked about when I was in eighth grade, but they showed me there were a series of trusts. So I was 18 when I had the chance to find that out. And also the first trust had been set up to come to me at the age of majority, which was assumed to be 21, but I came of age right when the legal age changed. And so at 18, I actually had control over a trust.
Wow.
Used that to get my education.
And so how did that feel? Did you actually feel that you had an abundance of money and that you now could do whatever you wanted to with it?
You know, that's a good question, because the secretary for the trust officer at the bank said, honey, you don't have to worry. You've got more money than you could ever spend. But I didn't really believe that. So I went through and I looked at all the different trusts and how much money they had and when they were going to come to me, and did the math to divide how much money there was by how many years, you know, there was before the next trust, or how many years I might live. And I came up with numbers of, you know, well, if I, you know, I was not making any assumptions about growth or income, but I kind of came up with this is how long this money will last if I spend this much. So that helped me set what did I want to give myself as a monthly allowance, because I was paying my tuition and school bills, room and board, but I also needed to have an allowance for, you know, shampoo and things like that.
Right, right.
So that's how I set my allowance. So I didn't trust the trust officers, whose information, you know, would have steered me down the wrong path. I did feel free to, I did buy a car as well, besides my allowance, that was a monthly allowance. And I really did feel, I mean, I knew that I was, I had many more resources at hand than most of my friends at college. And So I was aware of that, and I did not talk about it.
Okay, because I wondered if that changed your dynamics with your friends at college, where sometimes I found people then feel they should be treating everybody every time they go out to dinner, or it was their role as the one with more money to cover, you know, the check at the restaurants and things like that. You didn't have that experience.
I don't remember having that experience in college, even though my roommate for my last 2 years had grown up in a farm family. We were in Vermont, and she had gotten, as when she graduated from high school, she got $100 from her parents, and that's the last support she ever had from them. She worked and provided for herself. So it was a really dramatic contrast, and she knew, you know, she knew enough. I mean, they knew I would fly home to Michigan on breaks where my mother lived. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had a car, you know, I did feel an obligation to give people rides.
Right. Right. But you didn't feel an obligation to reveal.
No.
So what were some of your family's dynamics around wealth?
You know, both my parents grew up in the same small town in Ohio where they each were from business owning, you know, pretty wealthy families. And I think they were very uncomfortable with that. You know, everybody where they were, everybody knew, they recognized the name and knew, oh, you're one of them, you're a Stranahan. And they really wanted to escape from that and bring us up with a very different upbringing. So there was this real contrast between how I experienced our life, you know, with my nuclear family and the way the rest of the family lived. And it didn't particularly seem that odd to me. I mean, my cousins lived in a big house and they had a housekeeper and a cook and, you know, there were nannies and things in other families, you know, my cousins' families. And it never even really struck me as that strange. There was a point where I probably realized that we were different from my friends whose dad was also a professor, because we would go to Aspen in the summertime because dad started that center for physics. And most people didn't have two homes, or if they had a second home, it was just a little cottage on a lake that they could drive to a couple of hours away. So my parents really tried to much more to live as our community where we lived was, to, you know, kind of blend in other than the place in Aspen. And then when my father got close to 40, he bought a really nice sports car that kind of outed us all.
You know, I have another client who talked about their son talked about the fact that the way they were outed was when their dad bought a really nice car as well. So interesting that seems to be a symbol that happens that sometimes with families and especially through the father.
Right.
So how did you talk about money with family members? And conversely, how did you talk about money with non-family members?
Growing up, we're thinking, or?
Let's say now.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So it's interesting that in my family, when I was in my very early 20s, we started being invited into these family meetings where they talked about money. And also, I think we were primarily invited in because there was a family foundation that my grandfather said, hey, let's catch these grandkids who are, you know, in college, going off to start their own lives. We're never going to see them anymore, but maybe if we engage them in the foundation, we'll be able to see them. And so there was this very business-like way where you were reviewing statements or talking about foundation assets. We just started talking about assets we held in common, like Champion Spark Plug, or there were some oil and gas investments that my grandfather had made and given to us. And so we would talk about it in those terms. And there was this rule that we didn't share how much anybody else had at the time, even though my siblings and my cousins and I all basically had shares in the same trusts. It was kind of like there was this taboo about talking about how much you had. A few years ago, we were all at a big meeting and I had strategized and with my siblings and also the financial advisor who was going to hand out statements that had on the front page what your total balance of wealth was, mm-hmm. You know, around a table while we're at this meeting. And she put them out upside down and my siblings and I all turned ours face up and left them face up to say, we're willing to share this information. How about you? And everyone else kind of kept theirs turned over, which was interesting. So I probably am a person who pushes, well, let's talk about what there is. I talked with my nieces and nephews. I don't have children, but I talked with my nieces and nephews and showed them what I had, partly to encourage my siblings to do the same thing, but also because I'm planning on leaving some funds for them. And I wanted to ask them about their what they wanted, how they wanted that done. So I have moved from being very secretive and not talking about it. I think when I got married the first time, I'm not sure I ever even really shared all the information with my first husband before we were married, to really being quite open about it. And I have learned to be open with friends, that I am the recipient of funds through trusts that came from my family, and that's primarily how I support myself. And there are places where I've been comfortable enough to actually, you know, to share with people how much I have and in what forms. Mm-hmm. It's kind of an experiment I like to live, you know, what happens, you know, because like I said earlier, there's this way that when you have secrets, it tends to create feelings of shame.
Yes.
And so it's my way of experimenting with, if I share more information, because people are guessing anyway, you know, they don't know what exactly until you tell them, but they're guessing. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, well, what happens if I actually talk with them about it and answer questions? Mm-hmm.
This must have been quite a process for you to go through. And, you know, here in Aspen, where I live, I'm thinking about this one young man, and he is in his mid-20s. And I think he's a little bit in denial about how much wealth there is in his family. But the awful thing is the chatter that goes on behind the scenes, because I will hear people talk about him in terms of, oh, well, you know, he comes from money, but he's just not, he just doesn't acknowledge it. And it's kind of sad for me to hear almost the disdain in people's voices that he's not owning up to that aspect of his life. Did you ever experience anything like that?
Yes, I think when I was in my 20s, I was very secretive about it. You know, I think a part of it comes from that message of people won't like you if they know you're wealthy, and it makes you different. So it makes you feel, you know, we all want to be accepted. We don't want to feel different. We want to feel equal with other people. And this is something that makes us unequal. And it isn't very fair necessarily about how we're so unequal. But I think back to being in my 20s, and I worked in a bank. And so I worked in the trust department of a bank. So we had to reveal by law, we had to list any companies we had investments in, because they wanted to know we weren't engaging in insider trading. We weren't using information we were getting from work to affect our personal portfolios. And I remember how embarrassed I was to have to take in the list of the different stocks that I owned through these trusts. I felt that was held in confidentiality, but not that long after, the head of investments came to my office, which was a cubicle, and said, you're from the Champion Spark Plug family, aren't you? And I remember, you know, like turning bright red and, you know, what do I say? And the sense of, oh my gosh, I've been outed. Somebody knows. What are they going to think of me?
Right. Oh.
Right. I can still relate to we don't have good ways of talking about money we don't have ways that help us feel comfortable with it. So it brings up our fear of our own shame, about our fear of the envy other people might feel. You know, how do we talk about these things in a comfortable way that then leads to this way people are making judgments about us anyway? Almost everybody I know, you know, I'm a part of the Summer Institute program, and we really talk about these things there. And people generally say they realize later on that everybody knew that they had some money, that they were different. And people tend to make assumptions that you have way much more than you may actually have. And there are these ways that they're already judging you, but it's on assumptions rather than real information. So my thinking has been, rather than dealing with people's unspoken assumptions, let me just open the conversation and be more willing to be open.
You're listening to Family Dynamics and Impact of Wealth. For more information, visit our website, dynamicsoffamilywealth.com. And now back to the show.
You know, you introduced me to the concept of the green closet, which interestingly, when I was brought to, as you know, to Australia on a speaker tour, and I spoke about the green closet, but over there, the green closet is not, their money is multicolored. So we all talked about the multicolored closet that many of them all kind of percolate in and only talk with each other, if at all, about the money. Is there anything you'd like to say about this green closet?
Yeah, you know, there's this way we feel like we're safe when we're in there. And I'm thinking about what is it that we're feeling safe from when we're not open about it. And, you know, it goes back, I remember as a child being afraid of being kidnapped. And I think that comes from families as well, that if people don't know, you're less likely to be taken advantage of. And of course, that's the really big one, is to have your physical being put in danger. But there are other ways too that it can feel like we're subject to being used for our money if people know about it. You know, whether it's that sense of everybody's going to expect me to pay all the time, or people do ask you for support. They ask you for gifts or loans. You know, you'll find that there, if you're open about it, and maybe even if you're not open about it, there are people who feel like, you know, because of your good fortune, you should share your wealth with them. So it makes you vulnerable in those ways. And I have found it was really important to be able to say no to people, to be able to be out of the closet, you know, to be able to be willing to disappoint them. And if they ask for money, and to accept that there are ways that it does affect your relationships.
I did not know that you had a fear of being kidnapped.
Ah, yes. When I was little, yep.
Did your parents talk about that? I mean, how did you come up? How did that
happen?
Well,
I remember I must have been about 11 or 12, because I think it was when Bree was young. I asked my father, if Bree was kidnapped, what would you do? You know, if they wanted $1 million ransom, what would you do? And I was really asking, like, would you rescue me?
Right.
And he said, I don't know. I'd have to see what the FBI, you know, advised. You know, I'd go to the authorities, and I don't know what I would do. Which, my dad was always really honest. It wasn't really the answer I wanted. It was like, of course I'd pay the ransom. You're more important than however much money there is, right?
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So, you may have covered this already, but I'm going to ask it anyway. What's the biggest challenges you've had about and around wealth?
Yeah, that's a good question. I actually think my biggest challenge around wealth has been more internal. And it comes from a message I remember receiving from my grandmother, who married into the big wealth. She was from a well-to-do family, but not as wealthy or as prominent. And she said, or at least what I interpreted from her was, I had benefited from an economic system that harms other people. You know, that people who worked for Champion Spark Plug were helping to make the money that I received for doing nothing for Champion Spark Plug. And that I therefore owed a debt or obligation to people who have been harmed by our economic system. And I realize that has led me to feel that so deeply that I spend a lot of my time and a good bit of money to try to improve our social system, to try to ameliorate the impacts of our economic system, the amount of poverty there is. And I overwork doing that. And I realized it's because I feel like I've received so much, I can never actually pay it back. I can never actually give enough. I mean, I suppose one way to feel like I give enough is to give away all of the money. And I notice I'm not willing to do that. I like being able to live off that money and have the freedom to do what I want to with my time. But it has created this internal pressure to focus on how I can make the world a better place.
So you've just led me right into a conversation about legacy. I know you've come to accept the label of philanthropist, and I know that you interpret it to mean one who loves humanity. Besides your personal giving, which includes contributing money and time through the Solidaire Network, Threshold Foundation, and a donor advice fund, you have been involved in your family's foundation since you were age 21, starting with the Need More Fund, and in the last decade or so, the Stranahan Foundation. Tell me about the family messages you received about philanthropy and how they impacted you.
I think one of the messages was like that one from my grandmother, we owe it back. Another one was, this is a way to make a difference, and we have an unusual ability because of the wealth we've received as well as these foundations that have been set up to really think hard about how those funds can have the most impact. You know, it's not just about let's give out this money. It's about how can we have the most impact with this? How can we help people the most? And through the Need More Fund, I learned a lot about community organizing, which is supporting people to come together to get what they want. So rather than being handouts, it's more like a hand up. It's more like empowering people so that they have a voice in changing the system rather than us as people of wealth deciding how the system should be changed to protect the people who have so much less. So it really created this respect for bringing forward the voices of people who are poor or are that are subject to prejudices, people who are physically or emotionally, you know, endangered or insecure, and to respect in advance the solutions they favor. And that has really been a great gift that I got from my family. Mm-hmm. By us learning this together.
Yes, I know that your dad in particular is so much a champion of empowering people. And clearly this is something he's passed on to you. And I believe your grandmother actually was this exact same way.
Yeah, and my grandfather too. And you know, different members of my family have interpreted it in different ways, but there definitely is a strong legacy around that.
So closing on the issue of empowerment, I like to leave our listeners with a word of wisdom or an action item that they can do for themselves, for their families. What would be something you would like to put out to people, almost as a challenge, if something that they might want to step up and do for themselves or for their family?
You know, I think the impact of secrecy around money is so negative on us and actually on society as a whole that I would encourage people to live an experiment of finding places where they're willing to be a little bit more open. Take some baby steps around having a conversation that feels really uncomfortable around money, whether it's in answer to a maybe almost unspoken question, but to experiment and see how it affects you and your relationships to be more open. I think the benefits are amazing, both in terms of how it can enrich our relationships and allow more intimacy and closeness in our relationships to be that vulnerable and sharing something that's hard to share. I also think it's generally it is the person who is seen as having kind of more power in a relationship. It's kind of their obligation to bring up the tough issue. And so for me, it feels like a way of supporting other people by me being willing to share something that's usually hard to talk about, and to be the first one to sort of say, well, do you have questions about that? Or so I have found it enormously freeing. It also helped me get rid of the shame I experienced around wealth. So I like to encourage that.
Thank you. Thank you. Now, Molly, you and I could go on for hours, and I know our listeners would learn so much from a longer conversation. And I know you have offered to come back at another time and talk about a few other family dynamics and issues around the impact of wealth. So I think we should close the session for today. Let me say thank you, thank you, thank you for being so vulnerable, stepping bravely out of that green closet and sharing with us your story. And I look forward to when you can join us again. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Jenny. You're so easy to talk to.
Thanks. And I would say the same thing about you. All right. All right. To another day. Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Family Dynamics and Impact of Wealth. For more information on this podcast or guidance for having more meaningful conversations around inherited or sudden wealth, please visit our website at dynamicsoffamilywealth.com.